wanting to be a journalist in the US and thinking you can and doing it are two different things, simply because you don't have the cultural zeitgeist, right? You're unable to drop references to a TV show that because you didn't grow up on any of it.
This is the Indianness Podcast, stories of success from leaders and change makers of Indian origin. I get asked all the time, why have Indians achieved success across so many different disciplines around the globe? To be frank with you, I have no idea. But let's find out together by having a conversation with one of those people. I'm very excited to have Raju Narisetty with us today. Raju's current role as a leader global publishing at McKinsey & Company is the latest in a 33-year global career in media and publishing, during which he has created, reimagined, and managed major media organizations in North America, Europe, and Asia, like The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and The Mint. I invited him on this show as I was really fascinated by his unconventional career journey of going from Hyderabad to leading some of the most influential global media voices. As you heard me say so many times, there are two career choices for a lot of people of Indian origin, doctor and engineer. And Raju obviously didn't pick those two. So we are going to have a very interesting conversation. Welcome, Raju. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Thank you, Sanjay. I'm really looking forward to it. I love the idea of the label that you have for your podcast about Indianness, because I think so much of what we have done, even though we may have done it in other countries, starts off from our origin story. So wonderful to be here.
Thank you. Raju, as we have a global audience, and part of the purpose is to inspire a lot of people who look at you as a change maker, as a leader. In order to do that, let's go to the beginning, because that's where the journey began, and sometimes even before the beginning. Tell our listeners, where were you born? Tell them about your parents and siblings, etc. And then we're going to really go deep into some of those stories. So,
absolutely. I was born in Hyderabad, India, which is, I guess, in the middle of South India. Hyderabad now is probably India's sixth or seventh largest city in terms of population. And I spent the first 20 years of my life there. I grew up in a, by Indian standards, a compact Indian family, my parents, and then I had one older sibling. And it was a family rooted in a couple of ideas that I think have always influenced me over time. At that time, I didn't realize it. So I had an atheist Catholic father and an agnostic Hindu mother, and both of them encouraged my sister and I to really believe in education and books as the only way to think about what the future might unfold, and gave us a lot of freedom to choose what we wanted to do. My sister somewhat conventionally became a doctor. I was terrible at math and not particularly good at science either, and ended up being allowed to pick up history and sociology and economics and geography as the subjects that I cared about. So I ended up getting a BA in, I triple majored in geography, sociology, and economics, and then ended up getting an MBA or equivalent of that at a place called the Institute of Rural Management, IRMA, in Anand, Gujarat. It was really a institute that was set up with the idea that rural India and rural Indian enterprises could use some professional management. It was set up by Dr. Varghese Kurien, who founded Amul and is well known in India as like the pioneer of our milk revolution. Mm-hmm. So spent 2 years there, did that, and then actually worked for a couple of years in a big dairy products company selling cheese and butter, but also realized that's not how I wanted to spend the rest of my life. It was an inflection point, if you will. At that time, when I thought, what do I enjoy doing well? It was mostly rooted around journalism in an interesting way. I like to joke that I was probably doomed by DNA, because my mother was an English literature professor and my dad was a journalist and eventually an editor of a regional Telugu newspaper. So I ended up applying to a journalism school in Delhi. At that time, the Times of India School of Journalism, did a one-year diploma there, ended up getting hired by the Economic Times, India's largest newspaper. Worked there for a couple of years, was part of a team that launched a variety of news products. One was called the ET Esquire, which was the first weekend publication for any newspaper in India, but also felt like a year's diploma, which while it prepared me how to be a journeyman journalist, didn't really prepare me to understand the role of journalism in society, its interplay with law and all of that. And encouraged by a mentor and teacher in Delhi, applied to a bunch of universities in the US, got admitted into a few, could only afford to go to very few of them, ended up at Indiana University in Bloomington for a master's in journalism exactly 30 some years ago now. And so that was another big inflection point. But growing up in Hyderabad, for those of your audience who don't know it, it's a really cosmopolitan city in the sense that the population is fairly evenly divided between Hindu and Muslim. So we grew up speaking Urdu and Telugu and English, intermingling all of that. It was a wonderful childhood. But again, at one point, I think my parents had probably about 10,000 books in the house, all the walls books. And my sister and my favorite summertime game, when it was too hot to play outside, was to sit about 5 feet away from the massive wall-to-wall books. And so one of us would guess the title of a book, and the other one would have to find the book and the author sitting. And so it was kind of a fun game, but it tells you, like, grew up in an environment where my parents would get like half a dozen newspapers, All India Radio and BBC were playing all the time. So that, I suspect, is how I ended up being a journalist for close to 20, 30 years after that.
That's fantastic. There's a lot to unpack there. So let me just probe a little bit more. Mom and dad were academics, and obviously you grew up with books, you grew up surrounded by a lot of that kind of an environment. Tell us a little bit about the school that you were going to when you were in Hyderabad, the early school days.
Yeah, I went to a British school called the St. George's Boys Grammar School. Very Catholic, Roman Catholic. The reason I bring up my parents being atheists and agnostic was because I think it has reinforced my belief that if you invest in education, if you pursue knowledge and information, that could give you great opportunities without having to think about luck and fate and those kind of things. And that was very influential for me, even when I was at school. Obviously, a British grammar school, we had to do a daily prayer, things like that. But again, I think it gave me sound education. And then my college, I went to Nizam College in Hyderabad, which is part of Usmania University, a very liberal arts-focused college as well. So that's a bit of my education background. I think it helped to have parents who didn't put the conventional pressure that Indian parents are known to do. And perhaps my sister choosing to be a doctor was enough. You know how in India, Sanjay, homes, if you live in a house, independent house, they tend to have a name, you give a name for the home. And then on the other side of it is like usually the names of the residents in the house, right? We would always joke it was my doctor for my dad because he had a PhD in philosophy, doctor for my mother because she has a PhD in English, doctor for my sister because she was a medical doctor, and then they were just my name. So for a long time, it was like interesting that I was the kind of a little bit of the black sheep in the family.
No, that's pretty interesting. Academics were such a big part. Were you a good student, Raju?
I actually was a fairly middling student and almost failed 10th grade because I was pretty terrible of all the subjects in Hindi.
Okay.
But my math wasn't great either. But I must say that it was a bit of a... Up until that time, I was coasting and all coming that close to actually flunking my 10th grade. And that kind of really made me realize that we came from a fairly lower middle class family. So it wasn't like we had any wealth or anything. And it opened up my eyes to the fact of what my parents had been long saying, which is education is the only thing you have. And turned me into a much more diligent student. My 11th and 12th grade and my college, I was actually a national merit scholar in Hindi. I really turned because of that almost near-death experience in my 10th grade, but wasn't really good at math and wasn't really interested in it. And so felt like rather than try to go the conventional Indian education route of engineering and those kind of things, let me stick to subjects that I really care about. At that time, I also had a habit of dashing off letters to the editor there was a paper called the Deccan Chronicle. It still is there in Hyderabad. And I would dash off. My parents had a typewriter at home. So I would type letters and send it off. And I would often see them published. And that was my first indication that maybe I have a point of view that other people think it's interesting. So that would be my first exposure to journalism, if you will.
Oh, that's great. You talked about your near-death experience. Did parents say anything that when they saw you struggle, or was this a self-realization? Because a lot of us go through those kinds of moments, because that kind of probably changed a little bit of your trajectory that, hey, I need to pull my socks here. But how did that self-realization happen?
Yeah, so I must say that it was a real shock in the sense that while I knew that Hindi wasn't my favorite subject and math wasn't, I wasn't very good at it, I never expected to come that close to failing, actually. Grades came out. I was like, really, it was a real eye-opener for me as well. And when I thought about it, it was because I was also very lackadaisical about like doing anything about it. I was just coasting at that point because I was very good in English, very good in a few other subjects. And so I was like so confident of that, that I was like, my parents, to their credit, when the results came out, they were like, they didn't really say anything. They just, I think they saw me realize what a shock that was to my kind of ego, if you will. And so they were actually pretty supportive of the fact that I really needed to put some energy into it. And they saw me do it. So I don't think it was ever a matter of about my grades after that. And I must say that it was such a shock to the system that I could fail 10th grade, came that close to it, that I basically said that it's never going to happen again. And it didn't. Not that I was like, when you hear about people getting 99 out of 100 or 100 out of 100, that was never going to be me. Since then on, I was like, in the Indian sense, always a first-class student, if you will. It was a self-realization, but a couple of things clicked in place. One was that I get now what my parents were saying about the value of education, and that if I don't apply, that's on me, and there's no fallback. And that was, I think, self-realization.
No fallback. That's an important point. Any sports involvement at all when you were in schools?
A little bit of tennis, a lot of swimming. My parents both encouraged us to learn swimming, and I was pretty good at it, but not in any competitive way. I did play a little bit of cricket for college, but again, was fairly middling about it. Most of my passion was around things like quizzes and those kind of things, as opposed to a lot of competitive sport.
Friends?
Close and very deep ones. In fact, my closest friends are from my 10th, 11th grade, even now in Hyderabad. And they are there. And whenever I go to India, I try to make sure I visit them. It was interesting. This goes to show the multicultural nature of India. My closest friends were Gurmeet Singh, who was a Sardar, Jay Shah, who was from Gujarat, Ashok Atluri, a fellow Telugu guy, and Satish Joshi, who came from like Rajasthan. So we've this closest group. So you grew up almost internalizing and not thinking about religion and caste and language and all of that. It's a little bit more challenging in contemporary day India, I think. But again, being in Hyderabad, being able to switch from Telugu to Urdu to Hindi to English, I think you grew up in a really multicultural sense.
Well, that's so true. Telugu spoken at home or English, or obviously not Hindi?
Yeah, Telugu was the native or my mother tongue. Unfortunately, over the years, I've lost the ability to read it, but speaking is still there. And English, of course, was like fairly common as well, simply because we consumed a lot of English media at home. So those were the primary languages.
When you had this near-death experience, then did you have a choice in going to the plus two, the 11th and 12th school, or how did you end up going?
Yeah, fortunately, because I was applying for a set of subjects, so I ended up like doing history, economics, and civics, it's as political science is called in India. HEC, you can imagine, was not exactly the most popular thing for everybody went to math and science, right? Got in, but I probably would have not made it. Of course, if I'd failed, I would have had to repeat my 10th grade. But if I were aspiring to be anything other than those subjects, I probably wouldn't have gotten. I got into a pretty good college, but it was clear that, you know, I need to get my act together.
Yeah. But you spent 2 good years, built some very good friendships. How was the experience? Any specific memory of those 2 years, Raju?
Yeah, Sanjay, as with all things in life, you have, in addition to just the friends you grow up with and bond with, it's also the teachers, right? My love for English language was really accelerated. We had a very relatively young, she was probably in her mid-20s, teacher named Anandi Natarajan, who's later became Anandi Sundar and I think moved to Australia. It really encouraged us to study a lot of like fiction as part of P.G. Wodehouse, R.K. Narayan and all of that. Her with pushing me to study things that were like literature and fiction and nonfiction. And that has stayed throughout in my life. I read close to 30 to 50 books a year now. Some of it is because of my day job. I do a series called Author Talks, where we talk to authors of books at McKinsey. But even otherwise, I read a lot. I think those years were critical in saying, while you may have to read a lot of things because of your exams, it's also important to read a lot of things because of like fun and because they're interesting.
That's true. So Anandi was at least an influential person who might have steered you towards reading and maybe towards where it led you towards some of these things. How did you decide to go to Anand to this rural management? Because it was very different. Talk a little bit about, was that an accident or was that just a choice? Or
when you do your BA in India, people tend to do a set of things, right? We're clearly not going to engineering, not going to science. It's too late for that. A lot of them often try to go through civil service, take the exam. And I had never wanted to, the idea of working for the government was not particularly something that fascinated me anyway. And then a lot of other people like took entrance exam to like business schools. Or you ended up going to your MA in political science or something and go down the research path. I was always, even at that age, I was like somewhat fascinated by business. I studied economics and I just like, and a couple of my friends, Ashok Kluri, who's one of my closest friends who later became CEO of a large company that he runs now. We've always been fascinated by what business does. As a result, the idea of doing something of that nature was interesting. The reason to apply to, in my head, a written test and you had to go through an interview and all of that, was it felt like not a very conventional business school. And I also, I think at the back of my mind, I was worried about my math if I go to a normal business school. I mean, if I ended up to have as much math as anything else and was like hard in the beginning, but it was applied math and I ended up being pretty good at it. So it felt like an interesting school. And so I ended up writing the exam, doing the interviews and getting through. And once I got through, it was not a difficult choice in part because the options when you do a BA in economics or sociology or geography, those were my subjects, are not that wide in some ways. And then Irma turned out to be the best two academic years of my life, bar none. I think we were 64 of us. We got there. It was a residential campus. Anand is about an hour and a half or so from Ahmedabad and was the most profoundly influencing 2 years because first time living away from home, always that. But also like just interacting with like people from all over the country, discovering what you like and what you're good at. I ended up like specializing in marketing. I was very good in applied math in the end, much to my own surprise. Logical reasoning and those kind of things, which I didn't necessarily know I had in me. But more than anything else, I think Irma gave all of us, those of us who were in that batch or subsequent batches, life skills. The ability to deal with uncertainty and deal with like challenges, because we were dealing with, for example, our internships were a couple of months in a village, setting up a rural cooperative, right? Those kind of projects we did. So what it did to me was like, it made me realize that I can be thrown into any circumstance and I know how to deal with it and I can not be fazed by it. So it was a life-changing experience as you were coming into adulthood to the point where it's a class of 64. I graduated in 87. 50 of us are still in a WhatsApp group. And we have met a few times. In fact, we are planning our next reunion next year, which will be the 40 years of our getting to Irma. And so it tells you, like, not only was it profound in turning you into an adult, it created a set of relations that still very much persist. We're all over the world now, but we are deeply intertwined. In fact, we were just WhatsApping today about people are asking me, what do you think is going to happen with Joe Biden? That level of interaction.
I have some questions about Irma, but before that, I wanted to ask you a specific question, which is for our audience, maybe highly important. You didn't go for medicine or engineering, and you were not good in math. You had a little bit of a near-death experience in 10th standard. And then, you know, you graduated out of that. Was there at any time in your mind some level of insecurity that professionally, career-wise, financially, what is my path? It doesn't look great. What will I do? Those kinds of things, some level, a high level of insecurity. Because generally, the paths in India are pretty, unlike in the US or other places, and things might have changed in India. There's path A, path B, and then there's everything else, which is a big question mark.
Yeah, the reason that didn't happen actually was, again, because of my parents. My mother had always had a fairly steady job, but was a teaching role, right? I mean, in India, teachers don't get paid a lot of money. Father ended up, like I said, he had a PhD in philosophy. He taught for a little bit. Then he went into journalism. He was never somebody who had a career that was based on money. So grew up in a house where the value of money was never really talked up. It was seen as it's fine. But like I said, we were very low middle class. But it was always, choices in life were always framed as, if you study well, if you learn something, you'll have both an interesting life and you'll be able to afford to live well. So as a result, it was never something that it still isn't today. Occasionally, I've made career choices where I have walked away from roles where if I had stayed a couple of more years, I would have financially been so much better off. It gets harder and harder to do as you have older kids to put through college and all that. But it's been a deeply subliminal influence from that moment on, because otherwise I would have probably wanted to go to IIM as opposed to IRMA, right? So every decision like that, I can see how not focusing on the money aspect of your career is something that's now deeply embedded in my DNA.
This is again for our audience, Raju. What you're saying is having a strong value system and maybe a strong family, because you had good anchors in your parents. That was obviously the big secure platform. And then the values that they had created made a big difference, because there are a lot of people who face choices in career, in personal life. Some face deep insecurities as to what's going to happen. Am I going to get a job or lost a job, etc.? So the questions there were focused really on that. Coming to Irma, one question I had, did you ever meet Dr. Kurian, the father of the cooperative movement of India that a lot of people might not know? And Amul is such a force, not just because of the milk, but the cooperative society, the employment and everything that he created there, Raju, which I'm sure like the back of your hand, is an incredible story. Did you get to meet him?
So we were fortunate enough that not only did I met him several times, but he was the active chairman of IRMA.
Wow.
And he lived literally next door. So he was a presence. Wow. And then several of my friends ended up working for him as well in Amul.
Okay. At Amul?
At National Dairy Development Board.
That's how they call it, yeah.
Yeah. He was a significant presence and an active one when we were at IRMA.
Wow. So those were, going to IRMA again, an inflection point, Raju, because you came into your own. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, coming out of IRMA, I think, was the real inflection point. Going
inflection
was like,
point.
You didn't know what you're doing. You went there.
Exactly.
It seemed like interesting. The 2 years at IRMA were like profoundly impactful. Like I said, it prepared me for sure to deal with uncertainty and not worry about it. And that has carried through so many ways, coming to the US, moving around the world and things like that. And just gives you an innate sense of confidence that handling a crisis or handling uncertainty or handling like a lot of not having enough data. Because when you're dealing with rural India, when you're dealing with farmers, when you're dealing with like lots of those issues, it wasn't as easy as having a market research and P&L and things like that. So it just gave a profound sense of confidence. And I think IRMA was like such a hands-on two-year program that most of us left feeling like we could, if we set our eyes to something, we could do it.
And Raju, just touch one more minute. Being in those villages, etc., it gave you a sense of, obviously, people working with potentially very limited means and still figuring things out. What other lesson do you think that you learned that would be helpful to our listeners?
Yeah, I think the biggest lesson, again, it reinforced my own upbringing, was that no matter what your circumstance was, perhaps education was a way out of that. Because so many of Indians in rural India, as you know, over time migrated to cities. And education has been the path out of just having a small piece of land and not being able to expand that. And also, I think it reinforces the idea of resilience as a muscle, that if you're dependent on weather, if you're dependent on so many external factors, that you learn how to cope things that you can't control. And you saw that all the time with farmers. Saw them like really dealing with things that they, how well the crop will turn out and all of that. India is, as you know, very monsoon dependent even now. And also seeing the ability of people who didn't have a lot to find joy in what they were doing. There's this amazing movie which is around the whole milk revolution called Manthan. And obviously at Irma.
It's Smita Patil, right?
Right. At Irma, that was the movie.
Yeah. They just had a festival recently for that,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, I think it had a 30th or 40th anniversary or something right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
But the movie is a good example of being able to find joy in like lack of a lot of resources. And I didn't go through this, but several of my classmates went to villages and spent 2 months where there was like, you had to boil your water because there were actual worms floating in. So to live through that and be able to do all of those things, I think just builds up this resilience in you in some ways. And again, goes back to being able to handle any adverse situations in life.
So you think that has had an impact on you being there, embracing, as they say, embracing the uncertainty or the chaos and being resilient?
And also, like I said, being able to find some joy in it. And then seeing how education actually helps rural Indians transform their lives, I think was also an important, again, a continuing validation of what my parents had always been telling me.
Talking about education, you graduated out of Irma, but then what were the next steps? What were you thinking then?
I was recruited in the campus by AP Andhra Pradesh Dairy, which had a brand called Vijaya at that time. Actually, back to Ahmedabad from Hyderabad to be the Western India sales manager.
Oh my God.
It was fun competing against Amul, which was the number one brand.
Of course.
And I had fun doing it, but I wasn't getting much joy out of measuring my success in the number of trucks of ghee I was selling.
I can't picture that. No, believe me, anybody who knows you a little can't picture you selling trucks of ghee, Raju. But anyway.
But I remember like writing a letter to my mom. I used to write to her every week, aerograms at that time, writing to her one day saying that I'm going to quit. And her writing back to me saying, you know, you've invested a lot in Irma and your MBA and all of that. But if you find something interesting that you want to do, by all means, do it. I remember like saying, what do I like doing? And like I said, thinking back to, I like writing. I seem to like taking things and communicating with others. And so I applied to the Economic Times at that time. And one of the editors wrote back saying that we don't take people off the street. But if you go to this journalism, Times of India School of Journalism, and if you do well, that's where we typically tend to hire young, fresh people. So I applied. Again, there was an entrance exam, got in. That was a 9-month, very intense program in Delhi. There were about 20 of us doing that. And was a summer intern during that with the Economic Times in Bangalore, and then ended up being hired by them.
Was it during the 9-month program or that internship that you, or maybe later, that you said, this is who I am? Because there must have been some moment because of where you are now, because you were no good at selling ghee, obviously. Maybe you were good at selling ghee, but you didn't like selling ghee. How about that?
Absolutely hated it. So again, it goes back to your role models in life. A guy named Thomas Oman was the guy running the Times of India School of Journalism. He had spent almost 20 years overseas at the Associated Press and everything, and then came back to India to set up that school. And I really thrived under him. He ended up winning the best reporting award in that cohort.
In that 9 month?
Yeah,
during the 9 months.
Yeah, 9-month diploma. So it was a postgraduate diploma, so it was a pretty intense 1-year program. And it was Professor Uman who actually seeded the idea of you might want to consider going and working overseas because I think you're a good reporter. I mean, Economic Times is, as you know, the largest business paper in India. Being hired there, and I spent 2 years there fairly successfully again, gave me the confidence that I actually, you know, I think this is it. And it was a lot of fun. I loved doing. I was not a very good writer, Sanjay, ever in my life. What I loved about journalism was reporting. And the writing was just a means of getting it out there and going back to reporting on a different thing again. But I loved that. And so Professor Uman encouraged me then to apply to a bunch of universities in the US. And that's how I ended up like deciding that journalism is it for me.
When you said to your parents that you're going into journalism, any feedback from them? Or they said, as always, they were supportive?
No feedback. I think my dad was probably secretly thrilled that I was following his footsteps. But the fact that I was fairly independent and they raised us to be doing that.
Yeah.
And I wasn't asking them for money or I wasn't like doing any of that. And also the Times School of Journalism was seen as like a pretty good school.
Prestigious.
Getting in there was like not easy. And then being offered a job at the Economic Times, I think all of these probably reinforced their view that he seems to be knowing what he's doing.
How come Bloomington or India now? Is that just an accident?
Totally. I applied to a bunch of universities in the US, journalism schools. Bloomington was at that time, the India Ernie Pyle School of Journalism was in the top 10 schools. I went down the top 10. I couldn't afford to go to a few schools that admitted me. I just didn't have the resources. Indiana offered the possibility of getting teaching aid.
Okay.
So I literally looked up Bloomington in a map. You know, I knew it was somewhere in the middle of the US.
Yep.
And got in. And by that time, my sister had moved to Washington, D.C. to pursue her postgraduate medical school. So at least I knew somebody in the US. But remembering going to Bloomington and small town, 35, I had moved from Delhi at that time. 35,000 people. It was a huge shock in so many different ways. First 3 days, I was telling myself, like, there is something really wrong about this place. I couldn't put my finger on it. And on the third day, there was a mini traffic jam and somebody honked. And that's when I realized I was missing noise.
Yep, absolutely. And it's also a little bit colder than Delhi, for sure.
A little bit. My first snow touching was in Bloomington, yes.
Yeah, no. And then how was the whole educational experience? You know, you're coming from an India-based educational experience to, you know, it's a relatively a different. How was that? How was your
I was doing a master's and there were a few other international students. So it wasn't just a very American group. I found myself actually pretty good in terms of grades and all of that. In hindsight, again, I was too broke to take my time to do it. So I rushed it. I finished it in literally 11 months because I needed to
get to work.
Yeah. A huge break was I was one of 10 summer interns that the Wall Street Journal chose.
Really?
I was at Bloomington. In a national, I applied. I sent some clips from Economic Times and I got an interview and did well in the interview and got picked. One of 10. So that's
an inflection point.
Yeah, that was the break. I ended up in the Pittsburgh Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. And in a 10-week internship, and this was pre-internet, really, in a 10-week internship, had, I think, 8 or 9 bylines in the Wall Street Journal. Nothing major. But like, yeah,
but still.
It was seen as like
it's
this.
The Wall Street Journal, man.
Yeah. And so it did 2 things. One, it completely convinced me that I can compete at the level that I thought I could in the US. And it convinced the Wall Street Journal that, okay, this guy seems to know what he's doing. Sanjay, wanting to be a journalist in the US and thinking you can and doing it are two different things simply because you don't have the cultural zeitgeist, right? You're unable to drop references to a TV show because you didn't grow up on any of that.
Exactly.
So you had to really work very hard in your writing to get over the lack of Americanness in you. So that was hard, but I felt, and maybe being at the Wall Street Journal, which was a very, obviously a business paper, meant that I didn't have to worry about sports and politics. And so it narrowed the area and I knew enough about business to be, you know, dangerous. So I think that worked out pretty well. Even then, it wasn't like I finished my internship and they offered me a job. This was 91, one of the first recessions in the US and in the media world. So I went back, finished school, and was hired by a small paper in Dayton, Ohio. And next 2.5 years, 3 years there as a staff writer in Dayton, Ohio.
Business reporting or just normal, just business reporting?
Staff writer, business staff writer. Covered like the biggest companies in Dayton, Ohio at that time, NCR, Mead and others. Another serendipitous break, the business editor of the Dayton Daily News was an ex-Wall Street Journal person. So I ended up picking up a lot from Greg Strihacek, who's another mentor, about how to actually thrive at the Wall Street Journal. So when the Wall Street Journal called 3 years later and said, we've been tracking your work and would you like to come back, come and join us? I actually was much better prepared because I had worked for Greg in Dayton for 3 years and he taught me all about how to actually work at the Wall Street Journal level.
So role of mentors, which is something we talk a lot, is an important one, right, Raju?
Yeah, I can, over a period of time, like I said, Anandi Natarajan, my 11th grade English teacher, Thomas Oman, my
journalism Oman.
Professor at Times School of Journalism, Greg, my first editor in the U.S. and a huge influence on making me good enough to be a full-time reporter at the Wall Street Journal, have clearly made a huge difference in life. As Sanjay, it gets harder to find mentors once you keep moving up in some ways.
Yeah.
You have put a lot more effort into it. What all three of them did, too, in India and Greg, was help me overcome the lack of networking and the lack of connections that you have when you come as an immigrant to the U.S. And journalism, despite its egalitarian nature, people end up hiring people they go to school with. And I didn't have that. So it was always going to be a bit of a handicap, but these people allowed me to be confident about my abilities and then prove it to the world that I could do it.
So Raju, then Wall Street Journal called. And as you said, because they've been watching what you've been writing, so it was not just, hey, luck, etc. So you were back at the Journal. And then how was that experience? And then what happened?
Yeah, so I spent the next 14 years at the Wall Street Journal. Started off in the Pittsburgh Bureau, ended up like covering several different beats, consumer products, heavy industry. 3 years into that, they asked me if I would like to move to New York to cover the East Coast technology companies. And then when the confluence of tech and media, this was the AOL Time Warner merger era, was happening, asked me if I wanted to become the first tech and media editor at the Wall Street Journal. So moved into editing. And another major turning point in my career was 9/11. I was on the national desk and the deputy national editor inhaled a lot of smoke from the falling towers. We used to be right next to that, our office at that time. And he was really unable to work for about a year. So I stepped into the deputy role without being officially made deputy and really held the fort together, if you will. We were working out of a factory in New Jersey for a year because we couldn't go back to our downtown office. And I think showed enough leadership skills that a year after that, the managing editor of the Wall Street Journal, Paul Steiger, asked me if I would want to go to Europe and be the managing editor of Wall Street Journal Europe. So that was that allowed me to show them that in addition to being good at editing and reporting in my previous life, was also starting to be good at managing people and managing journalists.
Raju, you now have spanned multiple continents, and then you took over that role at the Wall Street Journal. Then again, you came back to what, the Washington Post?
No, actually, I quit the Wall Street Journal in 2006 because, Sanjay, I had been very publicly saying that the future of business journalism is increasingly shifting to China and India and that we should do more. At that time, the Wall Street Journal was owned by Dow Jones, and financially, it was not that resourceful a company and didn't have the resources. They agreed with me in my thesis, but the CEO of an Indian media company, HT Media, Rajiv Verma, reached out saying that we heard you talk about this issue. Would you like to come and start a business newspaper for us? So I used to go, but my parents were still living in India at that time. So I would go once a year, once every other year. I'd be very frustrated by the state of business journalism in India. So I would always, in my head, I was thinking a billion people deserve better business newspapers than the one, including my alma mater, the Economic Times. So when this opportunity came, I was like, you know what, I'm going to put my life where my mouth is. So I quit the Wall Street Journal, moved to India in 2006, and launched Mint in 2007.
Isn't that, again, for our listeners, a big risky move, Raju?
It was. I was like a rising star. I had by then become editor of Wall Street Journal Europe and was deputy managing editor of Europe, Middle East, and Africa for the whole global journal. I was the first non-white person on the masthead of the Wall Street Journal. It was, but this is where, to go back to my original point, not thinking of a career as a linear ladder to climb and not being so obsessed about money and titles and all of that allowed me the freedom to make that call. I had turned 40. It's possible that I also had that like weird midlife crisis too. But it was very rare in a journalism career in the West to be able to start something new from the ground up and the opportunity to create a newspaper. And Mint became the first world's first multimedia newspaper in the sense that we launched our website the day before the print paper. We launched video. We launched a whole bunch of things. This was 2006, 2007, very early in that multimedia orientation. Yeah, it was. A lot of people were quite stunned that I would give up. But something else that I've done in my life, Sanjay, is that almost all of my jobs then and since then have been in what you would see as terminal roles, meaning people aspire to get to where I got to. And so why would you ever leave on your own? It hasn't stopped me from doing so a few times since.
So again, for folks who sometimes face these choices, you're saying you don't, obviously are not driven by money. No, everybody is not like you, Raju. But let's just say if there were some substantial risks even in taking this kind of role. Yes, you were doing the ultimate thing, the so to speak, the startup in journalism, as they say. That's where at that time now the startup word is very famous. But for our listeners who face sometimes, hey, I have an exciting opportunity, but look, I've got an established thing here. I'm at the number three spot. I could become the CEO of this Fortune 500 company, but there is this exciting thing. What should they also be thinking like you did? And you did it successfully.
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer without knowing specific circumstances, but I can tell people how I come to those decisions.
Yeah, please do.
Over time, Sanjay, I've basically made these decisions by answering a fairly simple sounding question, which is, when is the last time I did something for the first time? In the sense that does two things for me, right? Which is that when something, and all of my jobs have been somebody has come and offered me something. I haven't gone and looked for it. But when something like that happens, answering that question allowed me to say, look, I can go do the job because I have skills they want me. But will it also teach me something I've never done before? And that has helped me kind of then make the decision, because I've always come to think of my career as like a portfolio of skills that I need to accumulate. And each one helps me get really good at something the next time and not worry about climbing the ladder. So when the Mint opportunity came, I had never like started something, right? So I felt, look, no matter how this goes, right? By the time I had become a US citizen, so at least in that sense, I could always come back to the US. And I knew that my journalism was good enough that somebody will give me a job, right? But I had never done a startup. I had never created something. Similarly, 3.5 years later, when the Washington Post came calling, I handed off Mint to my deputy, Sukumar Ranganathan, who then ran it for 10 years. But the Washington Post had never hired a managing editor from outside in 100 plus years. And their problem was they had a digital unit sitting in Virginia and they had a print unit in DC and they needed somebody to put it together. And they thought like this guy who did Mint, a multimedia newsroom, the right person. This was the beginning of the Obama term. And so many things were like, when is the last time you got a chance to take an institution like the Washington Post, create the synergy between web and digital, be the first of something, was the motivation factor there. And then subsequent decisions, including now, Sanjay, when McKinsey came late 2019 and asked me if I would consider being the publisher, for 30 years, I've not done anything other than B2C publishing. It's the first time in my life I'm actually doing B2B publishing. So part of me was like, I think I can help McKinsey a lot. I know a lot of things. but there's a piece of it I have no idea how to do. This could be a complete disaster. But if I do it and I learn this, that's another skill that I've never had before. That has been a very simple sounding, but profound way for me to make these decisions.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Do you feel sometimes, Raju, that you get restless after a period of time? I mean, you talk about that, am I learning something new? You have now, obviously, your career spans journalism, media business, and now consulting. Is there a sense of restlessness? Because I have a feeling that this journey is not over yet. There is still many more journeys to come. And again, this is for people who are transitioning also.
But I think journeys can be both like things where you change jobs, and journeys can be things where you do different things in a job. I've been now at McKinsey for 5 years. First couple of years were really all COVID years, right? Very different challenges, how to deal with that. Now we have a different set of challenges. McKinsey is about to enter its second 100 years and interesting opportunities and set of challenges. So I think what drives you to continuously feel like you're learning and doing something new and different can be in an existing role. It doesn't automatically have to mean you're jumping ship. And also, there have been times when people have come to me with interesting things where I have looked at and said, it feels like more of the same. So while I might be able to add a lot of value, maybe financially I might be able to do well, I'm not sure that it's going to help me continue to grow as a leader, as a manager, as just as a professional. So I think there are ways to keep your current role interesting and challenging enough that you don't necessarily have to look for something. And also, Sanjay, I have 2 girls in college now. And as you get older and as you have more responsibilities, some of these decisions are not as simple as you saying, it sounds exciting, right?
Yeah.
Lots of other people dependent on you. So yeah. I think, but having certain like ways of answering that question for yourself, like I do, I think helps filter out a lot of temptation.
Mm-hmm. Raju, I found one of your quotes very interesting and also very apt. And I want to share that with our listeners, if it's okay with you. You say leadership is managing between a telescope and a microscope. Can you explain that to our audience? Because I think that's a great quote. Now, that's your quote, right?
I've said that before because I don't think it's like an original in the sense that I invented that notion. Okay. But the reason I believe in it and I use it a lot is that, by the way, I'm not very good at it on occasion either. I think the challenge as you move up in leadership is, how do you make sure that you are executing well against your strategy and against your plans, but not living in the weeds of things, right? So When do you step back and be available to your team when they need you, but let them do the execution, but make sure that you're also there to set the agenda and set the strategy? Over time, you ask yourself, if you're introspective, Sanjay, is like, what is your one superpower, right? I have always felt over the last probably 10, 15 years now that my superpower is I'm very good at looking around corners, but also acting against it rather than being hit with it. And I also love managing people. So if you combine those two, it's important. There are times when my team gets a note from me about a headline, right? Very micro, in the weeds. But most of my energy goes to saying, what is the next big like product we are thinking of launching? So it's right. A struggle. It's a daily struggle. And sometimes I'm good at it, sometimes I'm not. Sometimes the team tells me, you know, we got this. Don't worry. So then they're sending you the signal that you're being too much of a microscope and you need to pull back and be a little bit more of a telescope, because the biggest value you can provide is by anticipating WhatsApp, what might come, and being able to respond to it.
That's true. That is so true. Raju, we've talked about a journey that's been an incredible success. Has there been any, again for our audience, any setback that has been there in this journey? And how have you dealt with them, if there has been, again, for our audience who deals with that?
And all the time, in some ways, Sanjay, because if you don't look back on a year and say to yourself, boy, I was so incredibly stupid with that thing, then you're not really learning. And in both professional and personal setbacks, I think all of the moves ended up costing my marriage. I'm a single parent of 2 girls now and divorced. And that was hard because I think you make certain choices and sometimes your spouse willingly does something and then it's hard on them, right? So that's been a hard price to pay in some ways. So there's that. Professionally, look, one of my biggest failures was being unable to convince the owners of the Washington Post that we need to have a paid subscription model. I pushed very hard. At that time, the family that owned it did not fundamentally believe in it. And I tried to convince them, and in the end, I couldn't. So I ended up like moving on. And then a year later, they sold it to Jeff Bezos, and now it's a paywall, is like of a business model, right? So I often think about, could I have done something differently when faced with a real clear opposition to that idea? And I don't know the answer to it, but I clearly failed, right? I mean, I left the Post after 4 years, and because I couldn't succeed in that. So there are moments like that when you wonder whether you could have done something differently. I've made some, I think I'm very good at like hiring people, but I've also made some really terrible hiring choices. Oftentimes when I've trusted somebody else's recommendation and not done enough due diligence, you do struggle with that. And even at McKinsey is, we are, and like I said, we are about to finish our 100 years. 5 years in, I'm relatively new by in the scheme of things. And it's a very, very successful, proud organization that has ways of doing things, right? And as a newcomer, I often struggle to balance between wanting to stay as a newcomer, still have that fresh perspective. But 5 years in, the statute of limitations on complaining is passed. I am the problem.
You own it now.
Yeah. Those are all things that you struggle with on a daily basis. Sometimes you succeed, sometimes you fail. And I think your biggest regrets tend to be around people issues, right? Making either like bad calls about people or So I used to think that a big failure on my part was when people left me to do other jobs. But over time, I've realized that actually that's a good thing, because if I'm being a good leader and manager, people leaving me to go on to do other bigger, better things is actually credit, as opposed to feeling like it's a loss. So that's changed my perspective on that particular setback.
Well, that's very helpful for our audience who, you know, they deal with these things all the time. Raju, to the Raju who's coming out of Irma, what would be some one or two or three things, a piece of advice now that you look back?
This would be an advice I would give myself every day and perhaps don't follow through as much, which is every time you think you're going too fast, in retrospect, actually, that's the right thing to do and you could actually be faster. I have never looked back on a decision or a year or a period and said to myself, boy, I should have slowed things down. When you're in it, when you're making a lot of change, it feels like you're like ruffling a lot of feathers and you're causing a lot, but it's almost always the right thing to do. And I think that learning and that ability to believe in that, very hard even now, right? There are times when I'm like, maybe I'm moving too fast. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I've never ever turned around and said I should have gone slower. So I think just if you're confident about data and you're confident about your decision-making to move faster, even if everything tells you that maybe you're moving too fast, I think my biggest advice to myself and to anybody else out there in the world of business.
Well, that's great. So don't worry about being fast, because sometimes people say general notion is slow down. And I think it's good to hear that go faster. Raju, we have towards the end just a couple of questions that we ask our guest. Give our audience your definition of Indianness. As you said, you like the title very much. What does that mean to you?
I think it means being able to thrive in a multicultural society where you treat people for their skills and not who they are and what they look like and what their names are. And I think that's the one thing you take away from being Indian. You can be very successful. Oftentimes, Sanjay, you get asked this question as well. Why does it seem like Indians seem to be succeeding in other parts of the world? I think we are actually very good at like kind of inheriting that ability. Sometimes we don't practice it enough in India, I think. But to be able to do that and be able to deal with like different race, religion, ethnicity, languages, I think we are inherently good at that. And if we can preserve that and make that into much more of a overtly practiced skill, I think it will continue the success of Indians for future generations.
That's a great answer. I love that. Rajesh, you read a lot of books, and you said you maybe, I don't know, 10,000 books, but you read 30 to 50 books, as you said. Is there one book that might have profoundly impacted you the most for our listeners?
The one book I would actually tell everybody, and maybe it's also my age, but I have my father still alive. My mother passed away a couple of years ago. I do recommend Atul Gawande's Being Mortal. I think it's a fundamentally profound book about how to live your life as you get older and not worry about longevity, but the quality of life. And the good thing about that book is it applies to you in your 30s, 40s, because of your parents, perhaps, but applies to you as you make choices in life. He's a doctor, but an amazing writer, Being Mortal. So I would highly recommend that book.
Fantastic. Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. Great choice. We want one person, not two, one person who's been the most influential for Raju in his life journey. One. Can be in your family, can be anybody, living or dead.
It's my mother.
I knew that.
Komala is her name. And like I said, she passed away a couple of years ago. My dad is influential, but I am what I am because of her.
Because of your mom. Now, tell me, was she able to witness when you became the head of the Washington Post, the Mint, etc.? Was she able to see that and savor that moment?
Yeah, very much. She, like I said, she passed away just a couple of years ago. She's been through, but she was also able to witness like the end of my marriage and the impact it has on grandkids and things like that. But okay. I think she was pretty proud of how we turned out.
Yeah, believe me, I'm sure she is. Raju, final question. You know, Nike has a tagline, just do it. What would be your Raju's tagline?
I don't know if it's a tagline, but just have a very high say-do ratio.
Very high say-do ratio. Can you explain that just a little bit?
Meaning that like a lot of people talk the talk.
Talk the talk. Okay, walk.
It's fine, but have say it and do it. And the ratio should be very high.
High.
Sometimes a lot of people do it, but they don't perhaps articulate and sell themselves very well. But I think having a very high say-do ratio, I think is
say-do ratio.
Perfect.
Wow. That's why you're a journalist. You've got away with words. Raju, this has been fantastic. Believe me, I could go on for a few more hours. I have so many other questions for you about your time at the Wall Street Journal, at the Mint, so many other things, but we might have you back again. But some great lessons that you've taught me and taught others about resilience, about values. I think that education can be transformative. I think that's one thing that keeps coming through everything that you've said, and not being so driven by money. Money can be a consequence that comes by. And just, you had some great mentors, teachers in your parents and also in your life journey. So thanks again. It's just been a pleasure and an honor to have you on the podcast, Raju.
Pleasure is all mine, Sanjay. And you're an amazing interviewer. You made me on the fly think about things that I haven't thought about in such a long time. So I appreciate that.
No, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Indianist Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future inspirational stories.